Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Kutzmita, and every week I am joined by Brent Johnson, the man behind the dollar milkshake theory. Now, if you don't know what that is, please visit our website, milkshakespod.com. Also, I encourage you to go to our YouTube channel, at milkshakespod, and you'll see at the top there's a playlist called Start Here, and there's a number of videos that will help you better understand the conversations that we're having here, particularly around the dollar milkshake theory and the U.S. dollar's role as reserve currency. In this episode, Brent and I return to a heavy-focused conversation around markets. We talk about the recent rate hike by the Federal Reserve, the market melt-up that followed, and potentially what this means for markets the rest of the year, as well as potentially what this means for future Fed monetary policy and whether or not they might hike again. Also, stick around towards the end because Brent and I have a little bit of fun, and hopefully you can join us in that humor as well. So welcome back to another episode of Milkshakes Markets Madness.
I drink your milkshake.
All right, Brent. Well, I feel like recovering from a jet lag coma. So I'm not sure if it's a fever dream, but did the Fed pause?
Well, that's a good question. Apparently they paused but didn't stop, but the market seems to think that they stopped and are getting ready to cut. So, I don't know whether that's reality or if your fever dream is just a hangover from talking to Hugh a few weeks ago or your 24-hour flight that you recently took, but it's maddening out there, that's for sure.
So they, at the end of last week's episode, we kind of had an off the markets conversation, and at the very, very end, where we're usually kind of sneaking in the salutations and like, hey, follow us here and go here, you had one last final words where you had suggested that the Fed was either going to do a dovish hike or a hawkish pause, and it seems like everyone would kind of label that a hawkish pause. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, and I thought it was a very hawkish pause, but I don't think the market took it as a hawkish pause. I think in many ways the Fed messed up, for lack of a better way of saying it, by pausing, but almost committing to another rate hike because he didn't commit to another rate hike, but he strongly hinted at it, and the dot plot showed interest rates going higher, which hinted two more hikes this year. But the problem with the pause is now it's thrown all these questions into the air. And I think there's been a bias all year that they're going to stop and they're going to cut we're getting towards the end of the tightening cycle. And so the pause just gave those with that view even more ammunition. And I think that combined with, these very short-term options, these one-day or 0 days till expiration options, and then with the amount of shorts that were present, just 3 weeks ago, a lot of that's been burned off now, but we've had this equity melt up, into the Fed meeting, and then the Fed meeting just kind of accelerated it. And so, I think in many ways the Fed has made their job even more difficult by doing a hawkish pause than it otherwise would have been if they would have just done one more hike and said that's probably it. To me, it's just, I've said several times on this show and in other forums that I think for the most part Powell has been one of the most clear-spoken central bankers that I can remember. But I think in this meeting, there was a meeting back in November where I think he kind of was wishy-washy, and then this meeting again, I think he was kind of wishy-washy, which is kind of starting to take away from that very clear-spoken, guy that's been around for the last couple of years. And so I actually think that the Fed is going to continue hiking. I take them at their word and their hawkish stance, unless the market makes them change, right? But the market screaming higher is not going to make them change. If this continues into July, then he is going to hike. And if it continues into September, then he's going to hike more. And eventually we will hit that wall, right? And whether we hit that wall in the next 2 or 3 weeks or the next 2 or 3 months or not till next year, I don't know. But I am convinced that the market is misunderstanding what the Fed intends to do. And if the Fed doesn't do it, it's because the markets are going to do it for them. And so, you know, we talked at the very beginning of the year. If anybody's new to the show, go back and watch the very first episode of the year. We talked about how sentiment was very low in equities, how positioning was way off sides. There was a huge short position in the market. We talked about how there could be a short squeeze into the first month of the year, which there was, right? That played out pretty well. And things went sideways for a while and then pulled back into March. And that was kind of how I had seen things playing out. And I thought that we would have a continuation of the correction into the end of the second quarter. But we didn't. We kind of went sideways for a while. But then in the last month, we've had this melt up. I think part of it was because, you know, the debt ceiling is now behind us. The Fed meeting is now behind us. We have another inflation print that was behind us. And they all came in relatively benign. In other words, they didn't throw any fireworks into it. And so, you know, with these big issues behind us, you know, the market, and then with what I thought Powell, was very hawkish, but I think the market interpreted it as dovish. You know, we've had this melt up, and now positioning and positioning is not super bullish, but it's no longer super bearish. But sentiment is extremely high. So there's a couple sentiment indicators, and they're very simple. This isn't like some rocket science tool that I use, but there's a sentiment indicator that I've used for a very long time. And it basically just measures the sentiment in number of like 20 different markets. And it goes from 0 to 100. Anything below 10 is very rare and means that sentiment is just washed out. Anything above 90 means that sentiment is super high and everybody's just, you know, momentum is just gung-ho higher. At the end of the year, sentiment for the S&P was around 15, and for the NASDAQ, it was like 5. And so that's why I was saying we could probably get that combined with the other factors led to the possibility for a short squeeze in January. Well, I think we've had now another short squeeze over the last 3 weeks, but now everything has kind of flipped. The positioning, like I said, is not super bearish or is not super bullish, but we no longer have this super short position. The put-call ratio, which was really high at the beginning of the year, is now back to almost its lowest level of the year. And sentiment is in the 90s on both the Dow, or I'm sorry, both the S&P and the NASDAQ. So over the last couple of days, you know, I've talked before how I almost always have some kind of hedges because I'm always looking to protect on the downside, especially in a very uncertain market and all these external events that could cause a rapid down move. But I've never been net short. It's always been kind of protecting long positions to protect us in case there was a massive drawdown. Well, over the last couple of days, after I listened to the Fed meeting and I saw the reaction of the market to what I thought is a misperception of what Powell was saying and what they tend to do, I have enough puts now that I'm functionally net short. So I think that it doesn't mean we're going to have a crash. I'm not saying that this is 1929 and everybody has to sell everything, but I think that now the risk is to the downside. You know, whether we have a 5% pullback or 10% pullback, I think sometime between now and the next Fed meeting, or in the next 6 weeks, we're going to have a pullback in equities. And so I didn't want to give up some of the gains that we have, and we have them fully hedged and are probably net short if I added them all up. So it's been kind of an interesting week, and that was kind of a big, long, rambling explanation of where we're at. But yeah, it's you know, and we're kind of in the dog days of summer now, and so you know, it's the next 6 weeks are going to be very interesting.
Yeah, so a lot to kind of touch on in a flyby kind of way. You have sell and may go away, but at the same time, you know, you already had a conversation going on around liquidity, and that liquidity was a factor. So you're going into the summer doldrums where no one's really behind their desk. Liquidity could potentially play a factor both directions. It feels like with the Fed pausing and somewhat of the argument or concern that you have and the insurance that you're putting on, it's a bit of looking for potentially that Minsky moment, because we've never had the Fed pause and then hike again. So, you know, the longer you go without a 100-year storm, the more likely that 100-year storm is going to happen. So do you feel like this is going to break that trend, that partly because of the dot plot and partly because of the animal spirits, that this could be the first time in a rate hiking cycle that the Fed pauses and then hikes again?
If the market continues to do what it's done the last couple of weeks, then I'm never certain about anything, but I'm highly confident that they will hike again. And even if the market pulls back, I'm not convinced that they won't hike. I've always said for the last year that Powell has said he's going to do it, and he's pretty much done everything he said he was going to do. Now, again, you don't have to love central bankers to just acknowledge that he has been pretty consistent and he's kind of done what he said he would do. And for all the people that said he couldn't raise without causing a recession, well, he still might. But the point is he's been doing this for 15 months now, and it hasn't happened, and equities are near their all-time highs. So even the people who said, yeah, he can do it, but it'll cause a recession, they might be right, but they haven't been right so far. And so the thing that I kind of liked about the Fed over the last year is, even though I didn't necessarily always agree with it, I understood what they were saying. They were very clear. This latest meeting now, and the other thing is, part of the reason we wanted to get into June is we had all this uncertainty, right? We had the debt ceiling, we had inflation numbers coming out, we had another Fed meeting. One of the reasons you like to get Fed meetings is because then you get some clarity. The market anticipates, but then when the Fed says something or they put it on paper, then you get some clarity on what you may be thinking they're going to do. The problem is that markets don't like uncertainty, right? And so the problem with the pause and then a potential hike is it throws a bunch of uncertainty in a market that typically has less liquidity because it's the summer. And then you throw into the fact that now that the TGA, or sorry, now that the debt ceiling has been raised and the Treasury can go out and start issuing securities, which they really haven't started doing yet. So you have uncertainty in a market that has just gone straight up for the last month. You have sentiment at extreme levels, and you have the Treasury coming in that will likely drain liquidity. It just sets it up for another possibility that we're going to have a pullback. And again, maybe it's just 5%, maybe it's 4%, maybe it's 6%, maybe it's 16%. I don't know, but the point is I don't think that we are going to continue to rise at the pace that we've been rising the last 3 weeks. And I think it's very possible that it's a hard pullback in a very short period of time. It would be nothing. I mean, here's the thing is, if markets pulled back 5% or 6%, they're still up double digits for the year, right? That's not a horrible thing. But if they continue going at this levels, at this pace without a pullback, then we're just going to have these extreme readings. And then we could really get a crash. So it's going to be really interesting seeing how it plays out. Like I said, I almost always have some kind of protection of some kind, whether it's just some cash on the sidelines, whether it's a small short position, whether it's some, puts that are hedges. But now, based on where everything is at right now, I decided I wanted to be actually, functionally net short. So, like I said, I think maybe we get one or two more updates next week, but I think by the end of next week and into the end of the quarter, we're lower than where we are now. We'll see. I've been wrong before. I can be wrong again, but that's the way I see it.
So you laid out a good set of reasons for why you're in the defensive posture. But do you tell yourself in the simplest form, from like a narrative standpoint, that this is the blow off top or this is the final melt up? Do you kind of start somewhat from that gut feeling and then try not to go all in or predict the future?
I try to have kind of short, long-term trades and then short-term trades. Usually the short-term trades are hedges of some kind. And the reason is that if you just look at asset charts, assets tend to go up over time. Right. And most of my clients are kind of long-term investors. So we have an asset allocation that if assets go up over time, as they typically do, they are going to participate in that. And we don't change those positions very often. Very rarely do we sell in and out of those. But what we will do is if I see a tactical opportunity along the way, either for hedges or to do some other little short trades on the side, we'll do that. And, I think that solves two things. One is it allows you to have long-term assets that appreciate, but it also allows you to kind of scratch that itch with some smaller trades. And so in other words, over-trading typically tends not to work out. right? You're often better off just allocating your assets and letting them appreciate over time, because it's very hard to time things. But, you know, I'm human and most investors are human, and they always get that itch that they want to go scratch and, you know, do this trade or do that trade. And I think by having a small pool of capital on the side where you do some of those smaller term trades, if you're good at it, it can actually either, you know, protect on the downside or help you add a little bit of alpha on the upside. But what it also does is it keeps you from screwing up your longer term assets. And so now what I see is I actually think, and I've said this for several years, I think equities are going much higher. And so I actually think what will happen is I think with sentiment the way it is, with the uncertainty the way it is, with the way the Fed coming in and probably draining some liquidity, I think we're going to get a pullback. But I think it might only be like 10%. And then, here's the thing. A lot of people cannot believe this melt up that we've had. They've been short all year and they just can't believe this is happening, right? This cannot be real. But it is real and it has gone up and they've been squeezed. And so now as soon as it rolls over, everybody's going to come back in. Oh, now the recession is really here. And they'll start shorting it again. And then it's those new shorts and those new put buyers that are now buying puts or buying protection 10% down that will be the fuel for another short squeeze to take it back up higher. So as of right now, and again, I always say I reserve the right to change my mind, but as of right now, I think we're probably going to get some kind of a correction. And then I think by the end of the year, we're probably higher. So again, we'll have to wait and see, but that's kind of my base case right now.
So like you said, you're generally long GDP. You see asset prices over time going up. So in certain environments, you're playing defense. Now, from your experience dealing with, say, people who are generally more of a defensive or takes short positions as part of their investment philosophy, a person who shorts the market overall, is there process when they have a view on the market, say that this is the blow off top and this is the final melt up, and they're short, and then they get taken out because of a short squeeze. Is there a huge reevaluation from someone with that kind of sentiment? Or do you see them immediately just taking fresh positions and new short positions?
You know, it's in the retail world, I typically see they just remain bearish forever. I mean, I literally know people who got out of the market after the pullback in 2008, and they have never bought equity since, like literally, which is crazy, but. And I kind of understand it, but I mean, that's a long time to remain bearish, right? And there's others who have, you know, got out of the market in like 2018 and haven't gotten back in, or got out in 2020 and haven't gotten back in. But to me, the professionals are the ones that can kind of move back and forth and kind of get rid of their view and just say, I was wrong, and move on. But the other thing is that you kind of have to distinguish between an investor and a trader. Like, I like to trade, but I don't consider myself a trader, and I don't trade that much. When I see an opportunity, I have no problem taking a short-term trade, but I'm not a day trader. I'm not doing 5-10 trades a day. But I think there's a lot of retail investors who are all in on one thing and then all in on another, and they're in and out and in and out. And maybe they're good at it, you know, and if you are good at it, that's a perfectly legitimate way to manage money. It doesn't work for me, but if you're good at it, I'm not going to sit here and say that it can't be done. So I really think it kind of depends on who it is and kind of what their skill level is. In general, you know, as just general advice, I'd say the more you trade, the more money you're going to lose. I mean, that's my experience, and I think most professional investors would agree with that. Because everybody thinks they're above average. Nobody thinks they're below average, right? Like, think about all the horrible traders in the world. And then, or just think about how bad the average trader is. And then realize that 50% are worse than that, right? So, you know, it's just a really hard game. And, you know, even the people with a lot of experience get things wrong. I mean, I get things wrong all the time. But I have kind of a process in place that keeps my mistakes from killing me, right? And so, you know, I think we've probably hammered that point to death on this show, but, you know, live to fight another day, so to speak, is one of the most important axioms in investing.
Yeah, if you were a day trader, there'd be such a different consumption of your time during the day that you wouldn't be able to be on Twitter so much. And, you know, no Twitter all day makes Brent a dull boy. And then
that's true. That's very true. And my friend Alex, do you know Alex Gurevich? I don't know if you've ever met him. He's a super smart guy.
Yeah, I haven't met Alex, but of course I know Gurevich, and he's very bullish treasuries right now, which is a topic we'll have to get into sometime.
Well, I remember one time he said this, and we all started laughing because it's so true. Like, it's amazing how quickly your mood can change based on one position changing. So, you know, if your favorite position is up 2% in the morning, life's good. But if some headline comes out, now all of a sudden that position is down 1.5% by the end of the day, like, you're depressed. Like, and it's amazing. Like, you know, just 2 hours ago, like, you were on top of the world. So, you know, there's all these rules that kind of, you know, don't get emotional and do this. But the reason these rules exist is because we're all guilty of them, right? Like, that's the reason, like, you know, when you read the Market Wizards, and Paul Tudor Jones has his rules, and, you know, all these people kind of share their wisdom. The reason they share their wisdom is these are things that they have learned because they did the exact opposite and lost money. It's not that they knew not to do these things and never did them, and that's what made them great investors. What made them great investors is figuring out a rule book that they could use, or a process that they could use, to keep them from making the stupid mistakes that they themselves have made several times. And it's the same for me. Like, when I come on here and I say, this is something you need to be careful about, it's not because I don't make that mistake. It's because I do make that mistake, and I know I have to protect against it. I have biases. Everybody does. And so you have to try to come up with a way to play your biases but protect against them. I mean, yeah, we've talked about this several times, but I think that's kind of where we're at right now. I think there's a lot of people who have been wrong and short all year, and now they're trying to figure out what to do. I think there's people like me who have been expecting a pullback and it hasn't come yet, and haven't been short, but are now expecting a pull. And then there's other people that have been long and they've been right, and credit to them, right? They're up really good, and now they're probably starting to think, you know, I don't know whether they're pressing their bets or whether they're starting to take some off the table, but I just feel like we're at it. Point in time where there is going to be an inflection point. And I have a hard time seeing the inflection point being 10% higher from here. Maybe it will be. Maybe it doesn't happen for another 10%, but I think we're at the point where there is going to be an inflection point, at least a short-term inflection point.
Well, the comment you made about the how much a position can change and then therefore change your attitude or your emotions is probably one of the reasons FinTwit can be such a toxic place, because you don't really know what people's positions are, but they're getting smacked in the face all day long, and they're just looking for a place to kind of release.
Well, nobody ever loses money. Nobody ever loses money on FinTwit, right? We're
exactly.
All George Soros on FinTwit. Yeah.
So one of the things that's always funny to me with the conversations around the dollar milkshake theory is, and we've highlighted it so many times on our conversations here, is it's really a way for you to push back against the prevailing narrative that everything's going to end and everything's going to end tomorrow. And I think the storyline as to how that's going to happen makes a ton of sense. It's the when that everyone just constantly gets wrong. And so the dollar milkshake theory makes a really good case for why this can drag on longer than it should. Now, it's also something, you know, since 2019, when I started to get to know you and guys like Jason Buck, where I really got comfortable with the idea of not knowing the future. And kind of like we're just joking, like everyone in FinTwit is making money and everybody is so smart, never gets it wrong. When do you, in your career and in your transition as an asset manager, when did you start to get comfortable and adopt this philosophy of I don't know the future and I need to start investing around that unpredictability?
I wouldn't say it started in 2014, but that's when it kind of really hit me that I just didn't know what was going on, or that no matter how much I knew, that I might be wrong, right? And part of the reason was because between 2017 and 2014, I did more work on kind of the monetary system and how it works, and government policy, and started getting into the euro dollar and all that. And I thought I know how much work I put into it, and I know it was a lot more than my colleagues who had similar jobs, and I knew I understood it better than they did. I didn't have a perfect understanding, but I had a better understanding than they did. And yet, in I still got some things wrong. And so that's when I had to start saying, listen, just, and there's this great quote, I can't remember who said it, but the biggest product of knowledge is ignorance, right? Is that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And that's kind of where I got into like 2014, 2015, is I realized, because I had been pretty bearish from 2000. So, you know, I was bearish in 2007, which helped. You know, I wasn't smart enough like the guys who shorted the housing market or the banks in 2008 to make a killing off of it. But I knew enough that we were going to have a pullback and a correction in equities that I didn't get killed in 2008. And then I was kind of bullish in 2009 coming out of it. But then I turned bearish again, let's say 2010 or something. And I kind of remained bearish for a couple of years. And again, we still did it the same way. We still had long assets, right? And so we made money, but not as much as we could have had I been bullish. And so that was a case where I probably remained bearish too long. And that kind of helped me learn this lesson that, either change your mind earlier or have your system set up in a way that being wrong for a long time doesn't kill you. And, you know, and that kind of leads to, you know, having the long-term assets versus the short-term assets. And, I think the other thing that helped with was, you know, you hear me talk, John, talking about all the time about what I would like to see happen versus what's actually going to happen. You know, kind of in the 2010 to 2013 or 14 timeframe, I was kind of one of these financial justice warriors. Like, I felt it was deserved. All the shenanigans and all the bailouts and all the, stimulus that was happening post 2008, I didn't think it was fair. I didn't think it was right. And so therefore I wanted it to fail. And that's not a good way to manage money. It's fine if you want to rail against those things, and it's fine if you want to try to change those things, but there's a difference between trying to change the world and trying to make money. Right. And so my job is not to be a financial justice warrior, because I might have different views than my clients, but my clients hired me to make money for them, not go out there and yell at the sky, right? And so all of that kind of combined, has kind of helped come up with the overall process, and then, figure out. There's sometimes where you're just wrong, right? Like the good example is in 2014, I was bearish the dollar. And the dollar went on a huge run in the second half of 2014. And I was like, that just doesn't make sense. But rather than just stay bearish the dollar forever, I decided to figure out why. And that kind of helped me figure out kind of where we're at today. If that hadn't happened in 2014, and if I hadn't been open to changing my mind, we wouldn't be sitting here today, because I wouldn't know what I know, and I never would have come up with the dollar milkshake theory. Some people probably wish I wouldn't have figured that out, so they didn't have to keep hearing this. But 2014 was kind of a pivotal year for me.
Yeah, one of the reasons I asked it, because I think it's such an important journey that everyone should eventually, find their way to. It's everyone goes along that journey differently, but I feel like what happened in 2020 to 2022 for a lot of people who are new to markets, and particularly in the crypto space, they're going through this similar like cognitive dissonance. There's not a learning going on. It's a lot of finger pointing, and I think there's a denial that the way that they've played markets has been sloppy gambling, and there's not this like comfort level with not knowing the future, and they're still kind of doubling down on these almost degenerate ways of approaching markets. And eventually, I think people who've learned about trading and took risk or oversized risk for the first time with crypto, I think will eventually find their way into legacy markets. And if you haven't learned anything, in the minor leagues, you're going to strike out really fast in the majors.
I think that's a perfect example. And the thing is, this is the whole thing. You can read all the books you want. You can read all the witty, one-liners all you want, but you really have to experience it yourself. Kyle Bass tells the story that the worst thing that ever happened to him was the very first company he shorted went to zero, right? So he thought, this is easy. I'll just short everything and it'll go. And it just didn't work out that way, right? And that's wisdom. That's experience. You know, we all have those types of stories. And so, you know, I've been through the dot-com collapse where it was a whole new paradigm. You old folks just don't get it. You know, this thing's going higher. And I saw it all come down. And then, you know, I saw the real estate go through the roof and, you know, they're not making any more land. So it's only going one way, you know, and then it all goes poof. So, you know, by the time we got to crypto, you know, when everybody was coming out with the laser eyes and the, you know, have fun staying poor, like many of us have seen that before. And, you know, many of us, it's okay that we have differences of opinion. We just wanted to try to impart some wisdom and people would say, have fun staying poor. You just don't get it. You just haven't done your research, right? Now, those have subsequently come down 60, 70, 80%. Bitcoin's down 40% or 50%. Listen, Bitcoin might go back to $100,000. Maybe we're going to have another crypto boom. I don't know. But the point is markets don't go straight up forever, right? There will be a correction. And, you know, but if you're new to the game and the first thing you buy goes up 5,000% or 500,000%, of course you're going to think you're smart. But, you know, those are probably the times you should talk to some people that have a little bit more experience and, you know, start to realize that some of it has to do with luck. Even though you may be very smart and you may have very good instincts and maybe you did your research, there's still some luck involved here.
Come, children, come sit around the fire with Grandpa Santiago so he can tell a story about the old man in the sea.
I am getting old. Look at this. It's gray. It's gray. I'm getting gray up here. Gray here.
I think that might just be blonde from you hanging out in the Puerto Rican sun for so long.
Could be. We'll go with that one. We'll go with that one.
Please go to YouTube if you're listening to this on audio only. We are at Milkshakes Pod at YouTube. Click subscribe, like it, and give us a comment. You can find Brent at Santiago AU Fund at Twitter. And I'm at Twitter at John Katsumita. We appreciate you coming along for our conversations around markets and our awful jokes. And Brent, any last words before we sign off this week?
No, just happy Father's Day to everybody. Enjoy your weekend and we'll talk to you next week.
This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.